The following podcast is not relating to my teachings and work at Del Cid Medical Center and is for entertainment purposes only.
Hola, everybody. This is the Life of Flow podcast, episode number who knows what, but we are at it again, tickling your ears and giving you the feels.
Jesus Christ.
Top charts.
Stop it.
This is the rant numero cuatro on the arterialization topic. In this particular rant, we had Dr. Brian Lipo, who heads clinical operations. He's a DPM, heads clinical operations at Hope Vascular and Podiatry here in Houston. He's my Robin, my Batman, my buddy. And
no comment.
We've been through these battles of arterialization for many, many years together, and I think he has tons of experience to share on the post-op management. And also are also a repeat offender to the Life of Flow. And you'll understand why I say the repeat offender as you listen in. Jill Somerset, RVT extraordinaire, who will also add her two senses on the matter of postoperative management and follow-up and surveillance of deep venous arterialization. So hope you enjoyed it. We'll keep on doing these rants as we believe they're a true necessity. Remember, this is entertainment only.
Mm-hmm.
So, word of caution, listen to us, don't listen to us, it's up to you. But this is what we do on a daily basis.
Vamos.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.
Well, here we are again, guys. At it again with another rant. This is rant numero what?
I don't remember. I think
you and I did one, four. Two, then Jill and came with three. So this is cuatro, right?
Okay. Yeah.
And nothing better than to have rant number four with four people.
Oh, there you go. Very smart of us.
I know. I've been thinking about this intro for a while. It's awesome, by the way. Lucas is starting to, I don't know that he's counting. And I'm, by the way, not this guy. I'm talking about my Lucas. But he knows the order of the next number.
Okay.
So I think he's just like memorizing this, right? And so I go, uno, dos, and this is the best game in the world. He just loves to scream, tres! Yes!
We should have him do that.
It's so good. I think we should really add it to like a jingle of some sort. Like, right? We're going to start the podcast. And I just saw uno, dos. And then he jumps and says, yes! And it's just like the whole, like, he's so proud of himself, right? God, where do we get lost in life and stop celebrating ourselves?
I don't know.
Right? These kids, like, he gets off a couch that he's never gotten off. And he looks at me like, did you see what I did? I got off the couch. And I clap. I'm like, that's awesome. And he claps. And then we're like clapping. And it's just like, guys, we just lost this, right? I mean, you should be able to be like, Jill, wow, did you see that great thing I just did? I don't know. It may be something dumb, right? Like some maneuver in your vehicle, or I don't know, you just like
parallel parking.
Yeah. Or you packed the perfect bag, right? Or you were able to fit the overhead in the perfect place where everybody was like, I don't think it'll fit.
You think you like the whole airplane
class. Like celebrate.
Yeah, like people should be like,
that's gonna become annoying.
That's
real
actually
fast.
You know, I think that's something I like about Jill. Jill will celebrate shit that people don't. Oh. Like she'll do a PAT at the end of the case, and if it's class one, she'll like clap and jump.
I know, but I get made fun of. Actually, you texted me yesterday or 2 days ago and was like, I did something really great. I can't wait to hear. I thought that was fantastic. And I was like, I hope it's MB1, MB2 on table.
That is it. Thank you for the plug. Just a reminder to all our listeners.
We need to publish this paper.
There is a classification about post DBA flow, MB1, MB2, MB3, MB1. Artery and graft go down at the same time. MB2, the native vessels are sluggish, yet antegrade. MB3, there's actually reversal flow.
Okay.
It's out there.
It's out there. If anybody publishes, suck it.
Give some credit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so today we wanted to land on, hey, we did a DVA, we clapped, we jumped, we said yay. We modulated the flow. We're happy with the flow that we're at. By the way, probably a lot more to dissect on that down the road. Because at the end, ultimately, I think the more I think about this, this Hundi number that we like is because it's probably the safest number for everybody. Mm-hmm. But not everybody, you know, I think people with 250 would probably do okay in certain scenarios.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? Like some people are more, will take a bigger hit than others. And I think that number is going to be personalized.
Based on the amount of native that they have.
Exactly. Left. Like yeah. Based on what you're starting with, like yeah. To Jill's point, like what's your PAT going in? Mm. Like, you know, am I going in with a two mm-hmm. in a single vessel versus am I going in with no vessels mm-hmm. or no demonstrable PAT, right? Like these are two massively different scenarios, right? One's yeah. got something to go to. One will take a bigger hit than the other. And so I think that can be a guide to where that number ends up. But anyway, I think that Hundi is safe. We did it. We'll move on. And we are now in the post-operative. You want to do it as soon as, like, in the recovery.
Yeah, we're in the PACU.
Why are you so hung up on the PACU? What is it about the PACU that you think is an important phase of care?
Because if they're going to be ischemic, they're going to demonstrate it in the PACU.
Okay.
And you better act.
And do you have a little ultrasound system that you'll roll in and do it yourself?
Well, I'll call the ultrasound tech there to yeah. come.
Okay.
But we already called them.
How much do the ultrasound techs hate you, by the way?
They love it.
Really?
They love it. They're like, this is so interesting.
Really? It's like, so oh, yeah. this.
Yeah.
It's something outside the norm to them.
Yeah. I mean, I bet you. Go, Joe.
I think there is a huge opportunity for new discovery and passion and excitement for vascular techs in this space. Like it's so yeah. exciting.
Yeah.
And I think there's such an opportunity for us to be super, super engaged.
Yeah.
Why are you looking at me?
I don't know.
Oh. Because
they live.
I agree. I guess and here's, you know, this is my to Brian's point. It's just out of the norm for them. And probably, you know, the older tech that doesn't want to be bothered with anything that's different, you know, may actually, let's just remove the older tech. Let's just say some techs may be just bothered by change.
Well, you just have to spend the time spend the time to explain it and what you're looking at. If you throw yeah. somebody into something, you just bark at them an order and they are struggling to,
yeah.
you know, do what you want them, then they're going to hate you. But yeah. if you are there and you grab the ultrasound probe, and you do it yourself and you explain yep. them and you go, this state. They love it.
Yeah. I think there's an opportunity to potentially take your time, go meet them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do an educational lunch.
Yeah.
Create mm-hmm. those alliances. And then yeah, it'll be easy. I think it'll be easy if you have any degree of emotional intelligence. It'll be easy. Let's say there's four of them and you'll see the one that's on their phone.
Yeah.
The other one's on their Apple Watch.
Yeah.
And then there's one actually totally into it.
Yeah.
That's probably the person that at the end will stay.
Yeah.
The dinner's gone. They all leave. And then that one person comes. That's your person.
Yeah.
Right? You identify out of everybody who's going to be your running mate. And that's person that eventually you're like, listen, do you mind if I tell you ever yeah. so often there's going to be some cases that are complicated? Because I think that what could be the most annoying is maneuvering that damn machine all over the place.
Well, I mean, they're used to it.
Oh, yes.
It's big, though. It's uncomfortable. Tell me about, because here's the deal. I think that you can also have pain from the procedure. You know.
Really?
You're breaking valves. You're putting stents. Like, there's other stuff that could be happening. You could have had a little hematoma.
Yeah, but it's different. The pain is...
And that's what I want yeah. you to elaborate on. Please, yeah. please elaborate. Hey, you did the volume flows. You came out of the OR. You're super happy. The patient's in the PACU. You get called for pain.
It's rest pain. They have...
Explain.
The typical rest pain. So they have rest pain in the dorsal aspect of the foot, not where you're stuck at the plantar aspect, and in the toes, in the forefoot. And it's the typical rest pain you see every single time you get called for a cold foot.
What happens if the patient had rest pain to begin? What is your expectation?
I don't know if I've been presented in the situation when I've done it for rest pain. I think the times I've done it has been HISA, so a hybrid, and I've had a couple times where the rest pain goes away, so I really can't comment to doing a endo DVA for rest pain and what happens is if I mess it up and cause ischemia. So I can't really comment to that.
Okay, so you believe the guy's got or the gal's got rest pain, and you did all your work before for flow. You're going to bring a tech back up to get another flow volume.
Mm-hmm.
And what number are we looking for to respond to that number?
At that point, you kind of have to use your judgment. You have to compare what you had before, see if it's exactly the same, and you're in the range that you want it. Then I think you're stuck. I think that, if you have it at 100, I wouldn't go to 50. Because I have no idea what's going to happen, and you can shut everything down. So you have to be super careful not to decrease the outflow too much in an extreme fashion. Start coiling and just leaving one outflow vein, because I think that's a recipe for your DVA going down.
Mm-hmm.
One or two, I think, is too little of outflow. But I don't know. I've never been presented in that situation where it's like flow volumes of 100, true flow volumes of 100. You make sure you get it in the spot where you feel comfortable. It is representative of what's going on. And it's still having rest pain.
I guess how many times, just off the top of your head, have you come out with a flow that you like in the safe spot and the patient still has severe pain that zero. You have to pick?
Zero.
Okay. Yeah. So it's a very rare situation.
Yeah. I've had it where
do you not check volume flows and then you go to the PACU and then they have a lot of pain and then you do the flow volumes and it shows a lot and so you go back.
So I've been probably doing flow volumes in and then it kind of establishing the relationship, because again it takes time to build a relationship so that people want to come. So so probably in the last 6 to 8 months I've established that relationship and I can ready access to an ultrasound tech in the operating room. I didn't always have that. When I didn't have that, I had that I can remember one or two instances where
you had to go back.
Like, oh shit. Yeah. So I went, did the flow volumes. They were above 300. And I just said, okay, guys, we're rolling right back.
Yeah.
Went and coiled, did it again, and it was fine.
Why didn't you just ligate bedside?
Because you hadn't told me about it.
but I think here's the super great teaching point to everybody out there following is don't wait, right? Knowing
don't
what we know now.
It's gonna go back.
Well, not even a day or two. Don't come out of the OR. I mean, I think you have the resources, you have everybody there, you just did a great job. You know, maybe you want to give yourself a high five and a pat in the back.
But again,
do not leave the OR.
This is our opinion as far as this flow volume is not like established in like hard data. So I think.
Well, but that's exactly why we have our own podcast so we can actually pontificate and say what we think you should do.
Go ahead and pontificate.
Yeah. I mean, this is entertainment.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, you take this as you'll take it or leave it. I don't care. I'm just telling you, if you're in the OR and you have everything available and you have a team, the dumbest thing in the world sounds to me like coming to the PACU, losing your OR and your staff, screwing your own time, getting a flow volume measurement late in the day to then go back.
Yeah.
Like, that just sounds dumb. So, take it or leave it.
Yeah, I've done it a bunch of times. Because not everybody has the resources.
I understand. So, find a way around it. My advice is different from Luca. Luca says, you know, create the relationship, get the RVTs. I don't know how easy that may be. My advice is learn how to do it yourself, dumbass. It's not that difficult. It really isn't. So that's it. So, I think that, we got Jill and Brian on board today, and I appreciate you guys spending some time. It's a Saturday. So it just shows how famous this podcast is. People actually take time out of their families to join us because it's awesome. And the idea here is to talk a little bit about what happens next, and how we go about those tough decisions in the first few weeks, And Brian, I kind of would like to pull you in and almost like a little bit of a storytelling, a little bit of a history, and even a little bit of our changes of sites of service in hospitals and how that's impacted our, what you and I call our mojo or our flow. Kind of tell me a little bit of this story about the arterialization from your perspective, how potentially disruptive it was and how different you had to rethink things. And tell me a little bit of, about that, because this is this part of the story. This is the reconstruction, the sitting, the patience, this, all these things that we've had to learn together.
Yeah. I mean, I think for, from the podiatry side, it's certainly outside the norm. And I think that's currently right now, the hardest thing to teach is to teach things that are not textbook. And teaching doctors how to perform things and do things that are sort of outside the standard of the norm. It's a new normal, but it's not currently the standard, I think, across the board. And so I think, you know, when we started this early on, you know, I still remember the very first case that we did. And you kind of warned me, hey, we're gonna have to cut off these toes. And I was like, well, wait a minute, why? They look okay to me. You know, and why do I have to wait for this? And so I think there's definitely, it was definitely a bit of a learning and educational gap from the podiatric side of things in terms of, you know, when is the time to intervene? And, you know, what we're coming to learn is that there is, you know, there is a delay. And that delay, I think, is very uncomfortable for a lot of people to know that, hey, you have somebody that has a gangrenous, ischemic, necrotic foot, potentially, that you're going to have to sit on for 4 to 6 weeks. I mean, that is just, it's kind of crazy to say that. And even today when I tell people that, or I, you know, telling the patient that, you know, there has to be a bit of experience and there has to be a lot of confidence to be telling these people, hey, you got bones sticking out of your foot, you have dead tissue, and we're just going to sit on that and let it wait. Because we all know that these patients can wind up somewhere else and somebody's rushing to cut off the leg because they think that that's a source of infection. And, you know, you have to kind of talk people off the ledge. And so I think there's a huge gap right now in terms of the comfortability for people to want to perform these things. And I think a lot of that just comes from, you know, the work that we're all doing. But also I think it comes from just experience. You know, I could tell people not to close a wound all day long. The reality is they're going to close it until they realize that it fails. And unfortunately, I think we were in the same position. You know, you would tell me not to close it. And we have probably a unique relationship outside of most where we respect each other and trust each other's opinions. And so when you tell me something, I try to listen to it as much as I can and heed the warning. But there are times where I'm in the operating room, I'm like, man, that thing's bleeding so great. Why the hell am I not closing it? And so I think there is that sort of learning gap that's going to take some time to come to fruition, you know, as we do more of these educational courses. And, you know, I think we as a whole that are doing these procedures kind of have a duty to, you know, sort of rewrite the textbook, because I think the only way it's going to reach mainstream is if you can go and open a textbook, you know, Rutherford, McLamory's, his podiatry side of things, and say, hey, you have this type of patient that underwent an arterialization. This is sort of the pathway that we're going to follow. And I think that a chapter is yet to be written, because I think we're still trying to figure out sort of where are those sweet spots. You know, so I don't think we're at that standard yet. You know, we've had a lot of success and a lot of volume of patients. So we, you know, we kind of feel like we know what's right. But I think, you know, you and I could probably both agree it's a little uncomfortable sometimes telling patients, you know, and other doctors, not just patients, but, you know, other members of the team that, hey, yes, they have, you know, metatarsal sticking out, there's necrotic tissue and the wound looks crappy, but we're just going to sit on that for 4 to 6 weeks. Go ahead and send them home and, you know, get some antibiotics, and we're going to wait on that. And so, you know, you have to get a lot of buy-in from a lot of people, because I think as soon as that seed of doubt is planted in these patients, they're going to start thinking, they may look to go elsewhere. So a lot of trust has to come from the team, and the team has to be very upfront. And I think just very honest about sort of what's happening. I think provide as much information as you can. But I sort of think that's kind of where we're at.
Brian, you know, can you give us like some bullet points, like really quickly, one-liners on the differences of how you manage a normal revascularization versus a DVA based on the podiatry perspective? Like what are the main differences?
typically, from a podiatry perspective, somebody comes in, has a normal arterial type procedure performed. They're ready to have surgery the same day or within, you know, within a few days. It's usually, okay, somebody has a necrotic toe, they undergo a revasc, you're taking the toe off same day and a couple days later, and then you close the wound and hopefully patient heals. That's sort of been the norm up until kind of recent. With the DVA population, it's much different. You know, they may have that necrotic toe. Well, you're going to have the DVA done, and then you're going to sit there and watch it. And you may have to take a toe off just because you're worried about infection, but you're not going to close that wound. And you're not going to resect that metatarsal. You're going to leave that thing open, that metatarsal head sticking right out of the wound. And you're going to let it sit 4 to 6 weeks until that DVA is matured enough to where you can go back and either do some foot scaping where you remodel the metatarsal head, take back the rest of the foot. But that's it's a longer process. I think in the end of things, however, it may be the same time that we get to that healing point, right? Because I feel like in a lot of the traditional patients that go sort of the standard revascularization, a lot of times those wounds don't heal all that great. You know, a bypass is a different type of population of patients, I feel like. But I think with the standard, you know, revasc, as you would, you know, I don't think it's so simple as you take the toe and it heals. I do find that there are failures with those, and you wind up kind of in the same spot if you were to leave that wound open.
But to the point, like, you do a guillotine amputation. Is that your practice still? You do a guillotine amputation on most of these patients and then do back?
You know, yeah, I mean, I think that's what works best. I still think that there's, you know, a lot of unknowns. It's hard when you have somebody that just has a hallux, gangrenous hallux, to tell them you're going to do a guillotine amp. You know, I think that certainly, you know, again, it's being comfortable with the uncomfortable. And I think that, you know, you take a first toe, then it doesn't heal. Then you take that first ray, then that doesn't heal. Then you debride it and try to put a graft over it, that doesn't heal. You do the transmet, boom, 3 months later, it's healed. Or not even, you know, sometimes it's 4 to 6 weeks and you're on the granular tissue bed and you do a and you do the skin graft and you're on the, you know, the diabetic foot remission spectrum. So while I think the open transmets are much more successful in this population of patients, I think it's very uncomfortable for a lot of people to get to that point. And I think, you know, I suffer the same fate. You know, we have several patients that have had arterializations that, you know, even to today, that, you know, we think we can salvage the foot, but, you know, I'm coming to learn that I can pre-predict that these patients are going to wind up with a transmet anyway. And should have we just gotten there faster? Are we doing ourselves a disservice? And more importantly, are we doing our patients a disservice by, you know, kind of taking a little piece here? We preach it. We say, well, we don't want to be that that meat slicing shop. You know, we don't want to just chop here, cut there, you know, lift these wounds, die back, and then bring them back for a TMA. But I think sometimes people need to see that. I mean, I hate to say it, but I think some, you know, especially with the families, I think the families need to see, yeah, well, you know, Dr. Lipo and Dr. Montero said he's going to lose these toes, but when he said that, the toes look fine to us. Mm-hmm. And so I think I think that goes for a lot of people doing these procedures kind of across the country, is that it's very uncomfortable to tell people when you have healthy toes, we're just going to go ahead and cut all those off and get you to heal. But I personally believe, from what I have observed, that doing that early, you're going to get the patients healed much faster, and you're going to mitigate sort of all the steps that kind of come in between. That includes additional hospitalizations, additional procedures, both on the podiatry and the vascular side. You know, it's not just me, right? You know, if that DVA is down, or there's an issue with flow volumes, or there's something that has to be touched up, that all has to be accomplished to be able to get them to the healing spot. So, you know, I'm cautious to say that the guillotine transmet is the way to go for all these patients. But based off what I've seen, I do think that's the case. I think if you want somebody to heal, I think we can pretty much predict, if you do the guillotine, pretty much predict the trajectory and the timeline for those patients with these isolated amps. And more in particular, I think the hallux and the first ray amps, I really struggle for one reason or another to get those patients healed in an expedited and sort of in a targeted manner. I find that it's just
like in a predictive manner, right?
It's predictive. Yeah. I'd love to be able to predict, you know.
The predictability is really hard. And I agree with Brian, what in the sense that us working together, we've come to the conclusion that probably everybody will do better in the long run with a guillotine TMA. The problem is that that's an overly simplistic way of fixing a problem, right? I mean, it's pretty mutilating. And it seems like, yes, if you think about the fact that we went from a BKA to the guillotine, that's huge. Mm-hmm. But we as scientists that are progressing this, we can't take that as the best result, right? Like we still need to figure out why is it that the rest isn't helping or working, and why is it that we're not able to do this more efficiently.
Yeah. But the Italians are a perfect example of that. I mean, they've been doing this, I think, far longer than we have. And I'd say, I mean, based off what I've seen from Federici, maybe 98% of his patients have guillotine transmets and have long-term follow-up. You're talking 3+ years. And they've been doing this way before, I think, we, you know, probably started really talking about it. And so, you know, I think that there clearly is something there.
But every so often we see a picture of someone closing a toe and working. It's like, hey, it worked great. And, or closing like a flap and struggling through it. There's some dehiscence. They manage, take care of it and it heals. And I'm always like, oh, I wish I could do that.
Yeah. I really think it's a matter of time. I think it's a matter of time. Listen, this thing continues to get better in time, right?
Yeah.
There is recruitment. There are changes that are, you know, biological. There's adaptability. There's re-recruitment of old hibernating vessels. There's, you know, recruitment of the Legare's plexus. If I think at the end of the day, you kind of look at the wound and the degree of infection, and you can decide, right? I mean, if the patient doesn't have like if you get in a patient that needs an arterialization and has like a small toe wound, I don't think that they need a guillotine TMA.
Yeah.
And if you get them through the procedure at a low volume flow and they don't get the ischemic pain, that patient is a patient you're going to sit on for months. Never. And the thing is going to heal up. And eventually the arterialization is going to be occluded and the patient's going to be better and they're going to get new wounds and they're going to heal like nothing. Like you've already essentially cured the vascular problem. And then you just deal with the diabetic foot, which will continue to give problems, but it's non-ischemic.
I have a patient right now that has two small little wounds, one in the medial aspect of the first toe and one in the lateral, in the lateral aspect of the foot and in the fifth metatarsal head. They're very shallow wounds. That's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking I'm just going to nurse this.
Yeah.
Forever.
Totally.
Unless it gets worse.
Those, you have to think of the mechanics too. Those are probably the hardest to heal because those are direct pressure points for shoes, right?
Yeah.
And so I think those actually are really challenging wounds. I mean, you know, maybe Miguel and I see sort of these train wrecks, the worst of the worst, and maybe that's why we're jumping into these guillotines because, you know, we don't have a lot of options. I think it's pretty rare that we see somebody that comes with a little distal tip gangrene or a partial toe. I mean, these are people that are coming in with, you know, necrotic TMAs already or necrotic forefeet. And so I think, you know, we're seeing these far extremes. And so there's not even options to just take the toe. You know, everything else is dead already. So, yeah. Maybe that's something too. Because we hear it when we go to these courses and as we're talking to people out there, oh, you know, I was able to take the toe and heal fine. They're showing these pictures of somebody had a small little thing at the end of the toe. And I'm like, we're seeing these people that, you know, their feet are literally falling off. So I think it kind of depends what you're getting thrown at, you know, or what's thrown, getting thrown to you.
Brian, we do get every so often when there's a patient that Lucas did in Austin and he relocates to Houston.
He gave me so much shit.
It's an ingrown nail. No option ingrown nail that I'm sending over for you to follow.
This lady had it.
So I just sent them like three of our pictures and I was like, the fuck do you do in Austin? Because like here we're seeing dead people literally walking with feet.
She had a
that
wound.
Came from Tales from the Crypt. Like, what are you looking at?
She had a wound because of an ingrown toenail. It healed.
Ingrown toenail.
That's how these things
are. Grown toenails. Pesky and grown toenails.
And then she comes to my office because she moved to Houston. And she tells me, oh my God, my foot feels so much better. I have no rest pain. I can walk. My toe doesn't hurt. I'm feeling really good about this. And she's like, oh, I moved to Houston. So, you know, I can't come see you so much. And I was like, oh, I know this great doctor in Houston.
I'm happy to get.
And I'm going to send you to
him
because he's such a great doctor. And I
said, and it was Brian.
Yeah.
He was talking about Brian Lipo.
Like, dude, what are you doing like these deep? I was like, oh, thank you for putting me down. I appreciate that.
Well, they come here with ingrown toenail and then we're doing a guillotine transmet on them.
Yeah, we send them back without toes. They look like our USB.
Take care of that toenail problem.
Yeah. Oh my God, I had a good thought about this. Yeah. And please, I'm sorry to all patients and patient family members that listen to the podcast. We obviously need to be very serious about this, but this is why the forum
that
we use is what you use, and we get a chance to make a little bit of fun. But I have to be mindful. Side story, and salute to you, because I know that we're still in the midst of it, but I had a daughter of somebody come out of the OR and be like, what was the flow volume? And I was like, what? I know. And I'm like, excuse me. She's like, yeah, what was the flow volume? And I was like, 92. She's like, okay, good. And I was like, oh my God. And it's because she's like been following the podcast. So she like knew everything about the procedure.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I apologize for my foul language.
We have this dark humor because
this is part of what we do, and this helps us balance our inner craziness, but we are very serious and take it very serious when we're there helping you or your family member.
Yes.
Anyway, but we're still gonna have some fun here. So sorry. Now here's what's happening. So where Brian, do you know where this 4 to 6 weeks thing came from? Because we keep mentioning it, but do you know where it came from?
Yeah, you know, I don't. I think that's kind of what you started telling me. So yeah.
I made that up. this whole thing has been a wag the dog.
4 to 6 weeks? Yeah.
Well, the 4 to 6 weeks, and I'll tell you why. When you look at the ALKMAR registry, they were looking at transcutaneous oxygen tension on all these patients. And you could see that at 4 to 6 weeks when it starts peaking. Yeah. And it continues to go up, right? So the transcutaneous oxygen tension in the registries where it was diligently followed. It wasn't diligently followed in the PROMISE II.
Yeah.
But it was in the...
ALP.
No, the ALKMAR.
There was an ALP, A-L-L-P-S, that they also did that. And it showed that the plateaued at
Leipzig,
months.
Singapore...
Yeah,
ALKMAR,
the lymph flow
Alps. You're right. Yeah. And that's where that data point came from.
Yeah,
and here is why. But you know what? That hurts my body like really bad, because I feel like that's just a very rudimentary way. Now,
why? It's great data. I don't tell them for this.
I mean, don't say great data. It's not great data. It's a registry of a few patients that we see a signal, but it's not beyond a reasonable doubt that we have this very clear.
I use it to guide it. And I say 3 months, because at 3 months it plateaus. So I'm like,
You're even pushing them more. You tell people 12 weeks?
12 weeks.
With a dead toe.
With a dead toe. Tell them, you're going to marry me?
You're going to marry me.
You're going to send me pictures for every day for probably the next 6 months.
Every day. You get pictures every day?
Every foot pics every day.
I don't know that I would have the bandwidth.
Jill's screening these patients, right? So, I mean, I think Jill could probably add a lot of insight to this questionable 4 to 6 week time period.
That's exactly, Brian. That's why I was setting that up for Jill to come in. And
I didn't want to interrupt. I was waiting for my time.
Well, I was
this was mansplain.
Chomping at the bit.
Listen, I am the second best world moderator.
The broadcaster. Sorry.
The second best after J. Cal from the All In. He's the best. I am the second best. But it was just a layup. So transitioning the conversation, it seems like, and there are other parameters, guys, right? There are parameters like the granulation tissue. You start seeing that it heals. The snake skin right? You guys know what the snake skin sign is? Patients come and like literally the pieces of old skin are shaving off.
Yeah.
And there's nothing literally more delicious than just peeling all that.
I love doing that.
I love, you know, I'm
delicious would be the term.
I'm a weirdo.
Here's my doctor pimple popper part of the day. I love when I get to do that because I beat Brian to the room. Because Brian loves doing that, right? But if I get in there, I'll like get my gloves, get a little 15 blade, and I'll start like...
And Miguel's got his fancy special gloves and he's picking at the feet. I'm like, whoa, what are you doing?
I know. And then I just pick all the like pieces of dead skin and I show it to the patient. I was like, look, I cured you, right? Like all this was your old ass skin. And it really is baby skin. So we start seeing the snake sign. Or the reptile sign, whatever you want to call it. Yeah, it's part of the, it's in the MB book of arterializations. We start seeing incipient granulation buds through the open surgical wounds. So like if we did any like temporization or any guillotine or and even if it's like if we didn't do anything, you start seeing a halo of granulation at the base of the gangrenous toe. I don't know if you've seen that. That's another one of the signs that like it's essentially it almost like pushing out the gangrene. And I see that at that month and a half. I'm sure that at the 3 months, that sounds even more, but that at that. So obviously, you know, you're seeing these clinical signs that are telling you that things are moving in the right direction, that things are starting to kind of there's a recombustion happening. There's a renaissance. But other than this old data, we don't have anything that categorically tells you, because this 3 month thing that you're saying sounds very safe, but sounds really like retarded.
Why?
Because it's not good for the patient or healthcare, right? I mean, well, having the patient go home.
What's the average time to healing in the
from the moment we diagnose? I don't care about the PROMISE II. I'm telling you, our group, within 8 weeks, the patient's out and ready, healed.
Okay, well, then publish that.
Well, of course, we're getting there.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is, if here's the, you know.
Because PROMISE II is 8 months.
But let me ask you a question. And this is all not mansplaining, it's setting up a layup. If you had a way that I could tell you, hey, at 2 months or at 4 weeks or at 1 week, this patient is ready for their foot reconstruction, would you still wait for 3 months?
No, but I have to know that. Right now, I'm operating in a space of a lot of lack of knowledge.
Thank you.
So I'm going to be super conservative.
So based on that, and knowing that there's potentially something we can look at, I would like to introduce our next speaker.
Are you going to interrupt her?
No, I'm going to shut up and let her...
Well, I love the conversation because I feel like this is a bit of an art form and unique for every patient. So we have snake skin, tissue granulation, and I think now we can use duplex ultrasound to use some objective data that I think can be really helpful in the decision making. And, you know, I think Brian, Miguel, when we work together on patients, we're still learning what we see with ultrasound and putting all the pieces together, but maybe that could change your decision on when you're going to do your, you know, foot surgery. And that's looking at things beyond flow volume.
So
tell me more.
That's what we would like you to expand on. If there are things that are still, I know there may be things that are still not out there or that you're not comfortable sharing. Is there anything about your current research that you may feel comfortable sharing about what potentially we should be looking at that could be an indicator that we that we're in a place where we can move on?
Yeah, well, thanks for mentioning that. Well, I think we have to not just focus on just the one flow volume measurement. We should be looking at the entire penis or pedal loop system.
Oh, we should be.
Slip of the tongue.
Wait, what? Don't edit that out.
We should be looking at the entire penis.
Do not edit that out.
You know,
step
you
one,
said it
lift
on
the penis.
The podium.
I'm like, what?
And then
I'm doing something wrong.
Listen, you. So,
as a podiatrist, that may be very hard for me to be justifying the patient. Hey, can I take a peek there?
What is going on? Okay.
So we say, here's the deal. Pedal venous, the pedal venous loop.
Oh, no.
And when you say pedal venous 10 times in success. Do it. Say pedal venous. Pedal venous, pedal venous, pedal venous. You're inevitably at some point going to say penis. And I said it at the Inari course. Brian, did you notice that? I said penis and I just noticed. Kept talking like nothing. Anyway, what was that? Is it Fight Club or what's that movie that there's this weirdo that would insert like super tiny micro clips into like kids' movies?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, it was Fight Club.
And it
yeah.
was like Fight Club, right? Yeah. That there was like a pair of titties and then like the kid movie would continue and all the parents would be like, did I just saw that? But it was like so fast that nobody would really... So I just said penis and I just kept talking like nothing. And I saw two people perk up like, what the fuck did I just hear? But nobody reacted. So everybody just... So anyway, we all reacted. So now it's going to go down in the books of history that Jill... So
that's the acronym. Okay, great.
Keto Venus.
Yes. So anyway, I think we just have to look at the entire hemodynamics of the entire loop system. But I also kind of love, and I wish I was at Hope more often, but even when you you get that, if you have to do a short guillotine amputation, you get that short loop, like connecting right by the medial malleolus to the to the GSV.
Yeah.
I mean, if Brian has to do some foot reconstruction, I think ultrasound can really help maybe at least give you some confidence of what's happening hemodynamically underneath the skin. And I mean, Brian, what do you think about that? We've had this kind of conversation before.
Yeah, I mean, look, I certainly think there is a lot of room for improvement for evaluation of tissue perfusion, be it ultrasound or some of these fancy technologies that are kind of out there. You know, I think the problem with fancy technologies is it's hard for the clinician to implement these into their workflow. Ultrasound may be a better complement because you have ultrasound techs that are there to do that specific job. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, you know, you're not adding something to the physician's already current, you know, algorithm of things to look for. You're bringing in another partner to that sort of realm of care who can certainly get a better evaluation. And if you're able to tell me, hey, there's perfusion based off of ultrasound, which I think is the most obvious way to sort of look at things versus looking at, you know, color mapped camera images. If you're looking at an ultrasound in real time that's showing blood flow to a certain area, like I don't know how much more real time you can get than that. And so, yeah, I mean, that's amazing to be able to have that ability. But unfortunately, most people doing this don't have that luxury. They don't have people like Jill that wants to come in and do these things in the clinic. And you know, I think that while I think that's an amazing thing to do, something we should certainly strive towards and work towards, but it's challenging.
Here's a concept.
Flow through the venous circuit mean anything as far as perfusion?
I don't think so.
Yeah, so what are we talking about?
She's just talking about giving you a global map of where potentially you may not want to cut if there's like a main outflow vessel.
Yeah.
You know?
Sure.
That hasn't happened in the past, right? What's up?
Oh, I thought you were saying, sorry, Joe. I thought you were mentioning like if you could tell me that there is flow now to a specific area, that's the time to start.
Yeah, but where would you measure that? Because Jill, you do see these like tiny new.
Let me share something that I don't think it's in the purview of Jill's research because this came from me, and we're looking at a thing that I have termed in conjunction with her maturation.
What?
Maturation.
Okay.
Maduración. Yeah, maturation. Yeah. Okay. And so we believe that this point where you can cut and reconstruct is when there's. When there's maturation of the DVA.
Yeah.
So when is it mature?
Well, what does that mean?
Exactly. Well, I can tell you based on Roberto's slide is when there's woundosome perfusion.
Mm.
Right? We just put a paper out there with 150 something authors all over the world that was a pain in the ass to publish, but it was about woundosome, right? Mm-hmm. When do you actually, like it doesn't matter how you get flow to the wound as long as the wound gets flow directly or indirectly. In the presence of advanced wound healing and all these things. But that should be your end goal when you do these things. Now, nobody, right, in their safe mind, thinks that doing an invasive angiogram, as Roberto has done very elaborately throughout the years, doing an angiogram every month to see the actual progression of flow as it's recruiting and maturing and all these things until you see this massive uptake into the wound, then you know that it's ready for reconstruction, right? You know that it's ready for a skin graft or all these things. That's what we've learned from him. This is not necessarily published data. These are things that he has shared on presentation.
But is it crazy to get angiographic confirmation at the time you are planning to do the foot reconstruction?
Say, I don't think it's crazy, but but I think that we should strive to find non-invasive ways.
I agree. But right now, with what we have, I think that's a great strategy.
Correct.
Oh, I agree.
I don't know about great. I think it's an acceptable. Acceptable, not great.
Okay.
It's not great. If you're like, you know, what happens? You do that and you're like, oh yeah, it looks great. And then the guy comes back with a pseudoaneurysm and had an intervention because you needed to do this great procedure. It's not great.
You shoot through the dilator, the microsheath. And when have you seen a pseudoaneurysm?
Yeah. And then I can talk to you about the resources that you're wasting trying to do this, right? And the contrast, you're exposing the patient and the radiation to yourself. Like it's just, you're not going to win this one. If there's a way that I can give you that certainty with a non-invasive, you would take it.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. But we were not there. And I think that that's something that we're looking at hope inside here in our data as we are making our techs look at these changes. And I can't share details because we don't know.
Yeah.
but we're trying to look at different things at the level of the skin, mm-hmm. at the level of the Lajars, attempting to identify what could be that point of maturation.
Yeah.
And if we can find it and we can categorically describe that, and then we can pair that surgical results in the setting of this finding mm-hmm. have led to successful foot reconstructions by the podiatrist, then probably we can go out and say, hey guys, here's something that we think you guys should be looking at.
Yeah.
And then we all together with multiple sites in the world can then start looking at these same things and saying, hey, I think this is a fact.
Yeah.
And there's a fact pattern.
And I think we've got this beautiful tool of ultrasound that we can put at the woundosome. And with the correct settings of ultrasound, we can detect flow that gives us some hemodynamic parameters that may possibly suggest maturation or, you know, other things pointing towards, you know, wound healing. And, you know, I think it's pretty cool space to look at this data that we're collecting. It's a comprehensive database, but I think we're onto something that's really, I think, fascinating and good for decision making.
And right now we're, mm-hmm. you know, it's just observation.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, I've seen ultrasounds where we don't find any of these things, but we're already at that 6-week mark. Mm-hmm. And I give Brian the green light to just go and operate.
Yeah.
And then,
how often are those like going perfect?
That we've realized that there's changes that we can.
Then you operate and just like heals and you don't have to.
I don't know. We haven't looked at the data and that's it. Like right now, all we're doing is we're really looking at these ultrasound details.
Yeah.
And we're sticking to this 4 to 6 week mark thing that's mm-hmm. kind of in our mind. And then the idea would be that when we've gathered, you know, 40, 50 of these, we'll start combing the data back and say, okay, well, how many of these were home runs? Mm-hmm. And how many of the home runs were in the setting of these findings?
Yeah.
And is there a relationship that's statistically significant? Because then at that point, we can prospectively then go out and talk to you and talk to Giacomo and talk to all these people and say, hey guys, here's a finding that we think is a good way to say when to reconstruct, when not to reconstruct. Because even to the point, it may be a good way of saying, hey, we've got really good changes mm-hmm. at the base of the toe. Maybe don't even cut the toe, right? I mean, maybe it'll heal alone. So, mm-hmm. Brian, you were saying something?
Yeah, I mean, Lucas, you mentioned an interesting point. At 6 weeks, do these all heal? And I mean, unfortunately, I think there's just so many variables right now after, even if they're at 12 weeks. You know, that I think that's currently, at least for me, one of the biggest struggles is that, you know, there's a lot of variables that are outside of our control just because of the nature of what happens in healthcare with these patients, right? You know, you can't you can't bring him in every day for a tissue assessment. They wind up in different facilities. They're getting different grafts placed. And so there's so many variables that occur after. So I think creating more of a standard helps to ensure that they're going to heal in a sort of a timely manner. But yeah, I mean, I would love to say anecdotally, I think that, you know, we have a pretty high success rate, you know, but that's very dependent on what happens with these patients after we're done with them. You know, I could do a beautiful surgery, put a nice graft on, they can wind up in a SNF, and a week later, the foot's gone to shit for poor care. The wound vac was set on a high pressure setting. Somebody didn't change the dressing. The orders got confused. I mean, there's so many variables that are really frustrating to have to deal with. And the question sometimes I have is, how do I better wrangle that in? You know, I can only do so much to type the orders in the computer, but once that patient leaves the hospital, you know, I think there is a gap that happens. And I think we, with this particular population of patients in general, have to do a better job at having some type of follow-up to that facility. You know, there is a gap in that link. And I think that's where a lot of the healing, the failures in healing, I think, occur.
Yeah. Can you go into a little bit of that? Because I don't know if everybody knows that, wound vac settings. Because usually people just go, boom, 125 or one whatever. And then just like suck away. And it
I think a lot of it is just observational. You know, but if you sort of think of the mechanics of a wound vac, it's a pressurized system. And the higher the pressure setting, the more I think trauma that it creates to the tissue. Number one. Number two, I think it easily collapses sort of the distal venules that are feeding those wounds. Collapses those down to where you necrose the wound site. I mean, I've seen it actually twice this week with patients who had successful procedure done. They were maybe 8 weeks out, had a graft, everything looked beautiful. They went to an outside facility, had a vac placed at 125, and you see a rim of necrosis around the wound, and the wound bed is pretty much ischemic. The central part is healthy, but the peripheral part of the wound is ischemic and necrotic because the wound back, and you could see where the sponge was and how it mashed on the tissue and basically created a pressure necrosis. And so we've backed off the pressure settings because we're not trying to, I mean, yes, we're trying to promote granulation tissue formation. That was sort of that's why the vacs are there. But I think for us, we're basically just trying to bolster these grafts to create a little bit of pressure to allow that graft to kind of take to the wound bed, but also pull out any exudative or any type of fluid. We're not looking to bring about exuberant granulation tissue formation. That sort of occurs over time based off of the arterialization and whatever product we have there that's trying to incorporate.
Yeah. Jill, you had a comment?
Yeah. So since this is the post-op too, I wanted to talk about the post-op ultrasound follow-up algorithm and understand what you do, Lucas, in your center. But, you know, at Hope Now, we're getting closer follow-ups with these post-DVA patients. And I think there's a lot to be said for that close follow-up to see some changes and even see some predictions, maybe a failure and success.
Yeah.
So Lucas, what's your time points of follow-up?
2 weeks. Ultrasounds every 2 weeks.
Every 2 weeks?
For 3 months.
What are you looking for?
I don't know. Any change. Because what we know is that if it fails early.
Love you, man. I love you.
I look at this and see how peaky it is. No. Because what we know is that if it fails early, it fails, right? So what you need to like make sure you get to that 6 weeks.
I hope they make a reel out of that. If it fails early, it fails.
No, if that's it fails later,
science right
no,
there.
Meaning that if it thromboses early, if the DVA circuit goes down early, then your chances of failure are higher. If it goes down after the 6 weeks to 2 months, 3 months, then you've already created a degree of maturation.
Understood.
So I'm super.
You prepared. Like the word maturation, huh?
I think people have used this before, but
Miguel, is this maturation the same concept as getting out of the fortress? Is that
yes?
Is that
yes?
Okay. Yeah.
I love when Brian says shit like that. No, it's not. I'm not being derogatory. I'm just saying I love that. Yeah, that we can have that degree of intellectually like
high level
conversations. Yeah. And because then you get what I'm trying to do and like what we're trying to do, and it just makes total sense.
Yeah. So what?
And by the way, this is an ode to you going to the Inari course, which just says, because this is one thing I told those folks, is like your courses should be bring the podiatrist and bring the vascular surgeon.
100%.
And they didn't hear me on the first one. They heard me on the second one. And I thought it was a super success. I'm not sure if they're going to keep doing it. I hope they do. If they're listening, do it.
Yeah.
If they're listening, sponsor the podcast, please. But they need to keep doing that. Sorry for that plug. But it's really the vascular and the podiatrist need to understand what the hell is going on inside.
Yeah, everything that's going on. It's very important. I mean, I think it's for the podiatrist to put their head in the sand about sort of the whole other side of things. I mean, there's a complete miss. You know, I think the podiatrist, I don't think they need intricacies of the procedure, but I think there should be a well understanding of the terminology and actually what's happening. Look at angiograms. I mean, pop into the cath labs. I mean, I've done all this stuff because I'm interested, but B, it helps me to understand sort of the dynamics. And I learn every time I kind of sit there and talk to you about some of these cases. I'm like, oh, wow, I didn't even think of it that way. And so, yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot more work that podiatry has to do, not just cutting toes and doing transmets. I mean, there's a lot more of an understanding that has to happen.
Yeah. I want to go back on the follow-up ultrasound.
Yeah, yeah, keep your train of thought.
So what I look for, so a lot of the times we have to kind of prep the inflow. And that can be, you know, a great prep, or it can be a so-so prep, or it can be a bad prep. It depends. So I'm always, you know, when I see these patients back in the clinic, I look at my angiogram and kind of like go back to kind of review what I did, if I did a good job, if I'm satisfied with the job I did. And if I'm not, then I'm going to obviously be more paranoid about it failing at the proximal end. And then the other thing I worry about, which I really, to be honest, haven't seen that much in patients with lower flow volumes, but what I saw a lot of times that I would think lead to this early thrombosis would be development of like the severe concentric neonatal hyperplasia at the end of the stent.
See that a lot?
I used to see it more. Now I don't see it as much when I've come down on the flow volumes, which kind of may make sense.
Yeah. No,
I don't know.
1000% makes sense. Yeah. Because that is a response to the mechanical barotrauma of the systolic thump.
Exactly.
So the moment that thump is less,
you would expect less.
I think
so. Those are the things I look for. How would that manifest on an ultrasound, especially the distal part? I'm not 100% sure. If my flow volumes, I feel like I see my flow volumes increase over time as the system maturates. But that's super anecdotal. And that's very variable because there's different people doing this flow volume.
Jilly Bean, you want to say something about that or no?
Well, I think, you know, imaging in the distal stent and at the level of the stent to see the intima hypoplasia, but then also looking at the change of hemodynamics, of flow volume and other things distal to the stent, like more of the, you know, mid to distal foot. I think that would give you some indication.
I would expect to see a difference in the structure of the waveform.
For sure. Right?
As it matures.
It might be less peaky.
As it matures, you'll think it'll be less peaky. Okay. I would expect it to be more peaky.
It's going
to
be dampened.
It's going to be dampened as it matures.
Yeah.
Oh, not as it matures. Sorry. Right.
No, I think that as it matures, it actually starts looking more like an artery. Like
an artery. Yeah. More
peaky. Yeah.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. That's
I'm
what
sorry.
We're
would
here,
that
I mean.
would we all agree on that? Because I've got the few patients that have actually gone on to Brian Miss M. We're dealing with her contralateral. She still has an open arterialization from the PROMISE 2 study, which is literally now going on probably like 4 years, like some crazy
super
number,
rare.
Like super rare.
Yeah,
but her duplex looked. There is no way you would know that her duplex is of an arterial duplex.
Of a venous, of a vein, you mean?
Yeah, you would not know
that
it is that.
A vein.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it looks so arterialized,
Okay. If you wait enough time, it'll look like an artery. We have a patient from PROMISE 2 that today, you cannot tell that that's a DVA, like...
Yeah.
You know, it actually looks like a bypass. It looks like a popliteal to something bypass because it's completely arterialized.
The flow, do you have a measurement of the flow volume?
I can't remember, but it just looks like an artery. Jill doesn't, I don't think Jill knows who I'm referring to.
It'd be interesting to know if the flow volume stayed the same, decreased, increased. Because if there, if
that's easy, we can look at it.
If it's more peaky, there's more resistance, so there should be less flow volume.
Are you going to give me peaky though? Is that, since you're not giving that maturation, am I going to keep peaky?
Peaky is going to be like a recurring like little meme in this podcast.
Peaky.
More peaky.
Listen, guys, before we digress,
so there should be less flow volume, no? Well, yeah. Unless you recruit it more, and then that would go against it, and there might be more flow volume.
Are you ready to wrap up?
I guess so.
Let's do it. Yeah. Jill, couple comments on the way out. Anything you're taking home today from this conversation?
Well, I still think that ultrasound really can play a vital role in these patients for close follow-up. So I love that you're doing the close follow-up, Lucas. I think that we just are refining the hemodynamics that we're looking at throughout the course of healing for these patients. And we just have to keep after it. We're up to our eyeballs in research, and that's a great thing. So it's
Jill, we're not doing every 2 weeks, right? We're doing a little bit more.
Not every further, 2 weeks.
Like maybe every month.
Yep, yeah. Every month.
Yeah, okay. Brian, any last thoughts? Anything you want to drive home for any of the audiences out there? Maybe some podiatrists that are tickled by this?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think this is game-changing, life-altering stuff we're doing. I think it's rare. We've talked about this before. I think it's rare in our lifetimes that we see a procedure that really can affect an enormous population of patients. So I think with that, it's just going to take time for us to fully vet and understand sort of the pathways to what's best for these patients. I think that the more we all stay engaged and work together, we'll get there. It's new technology. It's very exciting. As a podiatrist doing limb preservation, it's exciting to be able to provide these options to patients that otherwise would have lost the limb. And so, you know, I think we're... these kinds of forums, all the stuff that's getting done out there, it's great for movement of the technology. From the podiatry side of things, I think people should, if they don't have this type of technology and this type of sort of situation on their radar, they should, because this is the future for limb preservation for this patient population. So giddy up and get comfortable thinking outside the box when it comes to management of these patients, because they're not the traditional patient that we're managing, but we're having a lot of success. So.
And here's a plug of our team, which is, listen, there's a few of us out there doing this and doing this really comfortably, cohesively, doing really good research, following our data. If you're not in a position to offer it to your patients, consider calling us, man. I mean, I think that these are good procedures. You may be skeptical. Be skeptical. I think it's reasonable. I think it's responsible to be skeptical when there's something new and disruptive, as you should. But I don't think you should not consider giving your patient an opportunity. And if you want to learn, come, right? I think that we're going to be gearing up to Hope Academy courses on this particular topic. Lucas and I have been talking offline about doing some online stuff. We'll try our best to continue, but I think there are patients that are right now not being serviced and that they could get a chance. So anybody out there, consider allowing us to be part of your extended team to help you navigate some of these cases. Are we good?
We're good.
Guys, thank you very much. Have a blessed weekend, and we'll see you at some point in the future.
See you guys. Awesome. Thank you so much.
Ciao, ciao.
Bye, everyone.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.